Hey, this is Ben from That's a Spirit, saying support your local campus and community radio station, CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph.
Another love parade.
We hear the views of Iranians on the tough new sanctions just announced by the EU.
It's only making pressure on me, ordinary people like me, and I'm completely against these sanctions.
What massive clouds of stinking algae say about the state of the Baltic Sea.
And I'm Theo Leggett. I'm standing outside the headquarters of the British oil giant BP, where Chief Executive Tony Hayward is expected to fall on his sword, paying the price for the disastrous oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
That's coming up in Europe today, after the news.
BBC News with Victoria Meakin. Pakistan has vehemently rejected accusations contained in leaked American military documents that its intelligence agencies have actively supported Taliban militants in Afghanistan. The office of the Pakistani president described the leaks as unsubstantiated. The US papers, which have been published in Britain, America and Germany, contain specific claims that Pakistani intelligence helped the Taliban plan attacks on NATO, United Nations and Indian targets. One refers to an alleged meeting between insurgents and the former Pakistani intelligence chief, Lieutenant General Hamid Ghul. General Ghul told the BBC the allegations were false.
This is pure fiction, which is being sold as intelligence. It's not intelligence. It may have a financial angle to it, but more than that, it is not hardcore. I'm an old veteran. I know this is not intelligence.
The US has also condemned the leaking of the documents, saying it puts the lives of NATO and Afghan service personnel at risk. The documents published by the internet site WikiLeaks detail, among other things, the killing of Afghan civilians by NATO forces. Its founder, Julian Assange, said they appear to reveal evidence of war crimes.
It is up to a court to decide, clearly, whether something is, in the end, a crime. That said, prima facie, there does appear to be evidence of war crimes in this material. An example is the Task Force 373 HIMARS missile strike on a house which killed seven children.
The European Union has formally adopted new, tougher sanctions against Iran over its nuclear programme. EU foreign ministers agreed on measures including a halt to new investment in Iran's oil and gas sector and restrictions on cargo flights. EU countries and the United States accuse Iran of trying to develop nuclear weapons, a charge it denies. A court in the Seychelles has sentenced 11 Somalis to 10 years in prison for piracy-related offences. The pirates were captured last year as they tried to hijack a boat belonging to the Seychelles Coast Guard. Mary Harper reports.
This is the first time Somali pirates have been prosecuted and convicted in the Seychelles. About 30 other Somalis are being held in the island's only jail, awaiting trial. Earlier this year, the Seychelles signed an agreement with the United Nations and the European Union to prosecute suspected pirates. Ships have regularly been attacked off the Seychelles, even though the islands lie more than 1,000 kilometres from the Somali coast.
The High Court in Britain has ruled that the government is acting unlawfully in speeding up the deportation of foreign nationals who've been refused permission to stay in the country. The judge said people were being given little or no notice of removal and were being deprived of access to justice. This is the World News from the BBC. The man known as the Khmer Rouge's torturer-in-chief has been told he must spend 19 years in jail for war crimes and crimes against humanity. A UN-backed tribunal in Cambodia sentenced Kang Kek Eo, better known as Comrade Doik, to 35 years imprisonment to be adjusted for time served. Comrade Doik is the first senior Khmer Rouge figure to face justice. Directors of the oil giant BP are meeting to discuss the future of its embattled chief executive Tony Hayward. Earlier, BP said no final decision on his position in the firm had been made. On Sunday, the BBC reported that Mr. Hayward, who's been widely criticised over the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, was to stand down. Theo Leggett has more.
On a grey and rainy day in London, BP's board have assembled for a meeting which is expected to decide the company's strategy for the future as it tries to rebuild its reputation in the wake of the disastrous oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico. All the signs are that Tony Hayward will be asked to step down as chief executive, to appease critics in the US government and to placate an American public infuriated by his statements, which have been widely decried as tactless and insensitive. His replacement is likely to be Robert Dudley, an American executive who was born in New York but raised in the Mississippi region.
Police in France have questioned the elderly heiress to the L'Oreal cosmetic fortune, Liliane Bettencourt, over allegations of illegal donations to President Nicolas Sarkozy's 2007 election campaign. Mr. Sarkozy and a cabinet minister caught up in the affair deny any wrongdoing. Mrs. Bettencourt's former financial advisor has denied the accusations against her. Russia says it has disrupted an attempt to establish a regular supply of cocaine to nightclubs and rich clients in Moscow. The head of the Russian anti-drugs agency, Viktor Ivanov, said a man who had sought to import the drug in 100-kilogram batches from the US had been arrested. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. Welcome to Europe Today. I'm Paul Henley. First, the German Chancellor has called for the investigation into the weekend's tragedy at the Love Parade Festival to be scrupulously thorough. 342 people were injured and 19 killed as huge crowds crushed to get through a single tunnel, which was the event's only entry and exit point. The techno music party was set up for around 250,000 people, but between 500,000 and 1 million attended. Police say their advance warnings about safety were not heeded. Today, the mayor of Duisburg, Adolf Sauerland, had to flee from the scene of the stampede after an angry crowd turned on him, blaming him for the deaths.
Sauerland, Frau! Sauerland, Frau!
Dass das notwendig ist!
Die Tote!
They're shouting, Sauerland out, you're a coward for leaving. Well, earlier speaking on the regional radio station WDR2, the mayor had been talking about how others locally had reacted to the tragedy.
The entire city is in mourning and in shock. We'll therefore open up a book of condolence and are preparing a memorial in cooperation with the churches in Duisburg. Then we will, of course, as far as we can, contribute to an explanation and review the events at the scene.
In a moment we'll hear from the police officer who took the first emergency calls in Duisburg. First, the BBC's Steve Holden is there today and has been to visit the tunnel where the deaths took place.
As you can hear, it's pouring with rain, but on Saturday, the sun was shining, it was hot. A huge crowd of people had come here to enjoy the free music festival. They were queuing up in front of this tunnel to get in. Walking into the tunnel, and it stretches for about 400 metres with occasional air pockets. It's very wide, very echoey. About halfway down on the left-hand side is a ramp, and this was the entrance and exit to the venue, which was an old freight depot covered in graffiti. Thousands of people were wedged in waiting. The problems are said to have begun when police shut off this entrance to people coming in and out. Trouble was, there was no room for anyone to turn around, and as more people kept on coming, the situation got worse and worse. People were trying to get out of the crowd any way they could, climbing up banks, being pulled up the walls. At the end of it, 19 people were dead. At least 340 were injured. On the floor, you can see the outlines of two people marked in white paint, numbered 14 and 15. They were two of the victims. 19-year-old Amy was there that day. She'd been there all afternoon and was trying to come out of the venue.
We saw people who were climbing up fences and climbing up the walls. There were thousands and thousands of people who were just trying to get through this exit and this entrance, and everyone was going in different directions, and there were people who were crying. Everyone was very stressy. There were quite a lot of people laying on the floor. They were all very pale, and at this time we still hadn't realised what had happened. There were people laying on the floor. Everyone was so pale and they looked so ill, and they couldn't get enough air because I felt the same. I couldn't breathe. I said to my friend Yasmin, I think someone's died. I think something's happened. Everyone seems sad. The atmosphere is different here. But we just couldn't believe that something like that would happen.
There's bleak strip lighting all along the ceiling of this tunnel, and there are temporary shrines with candles burning, reminders of the tragedy that happened. One sign simply says Warum, which is the German word for why. As paramedics treated the injured, the festival continued in the background, people unaware of what was going on. Organisers thought by stopping it, it would cause even more panic. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has promised an intensive investigation. Organisers of Love Parade say the event will never be held again.
Steve Holden reporting from Duisburg. I've been speaking to Wolfgang Oschescheck, who is deputy chairman of the German police union in the state North Rhine-Westphalia. He was in charge in police headquarters as the disaster happened and took the first emergency calls.
It only became clear to me that something disastrous had happened after a while, because it happened when my relief was about to start. I had been told that two people may be dead, so when I got home half an hour later, I learned that we had at least 10 casualties.
But was there a clear warning that the venue simply wasn't big enough?
After it was certain that the organizers had announced 500,000 visitors and the scene was only designed for a maximum of 250,000 people, there were concerns. We knew that the Love Parade 2 years ago in Essen had attracted 1.6 million visitors, and this being said, one could have resorted to the experiences and said, these figures don't match.
Is that tantamount to saying you said it shouldn't go ahead?
That's right. If you just let the figures speak for themselves, you see that it just can't work. Of course, security services are in talks with the organizers. But in the end, the organizers and the city of Duisburg come to a conclusion, and the conclusion was that the Love Parade should go ahead. So the police and the other security services had to come to terms with the situation.
But was there nothing, as events were unfolding, that the police could have done to stop the disaster?
We put up barriers at the time. The prosecution services will now investigate what exactly happened in the tunnel.
But couldn't the police, for instance, have ripped the barriers down?
The problem was that the police has a certain decision-making process, and these take times. The police weren't at the barriers. The barriers were being watched by the organizer's security team. I wasn't at the scene and don't want to judge.
That was Wolfgang Oschescheck in charge at police headquarters in Duisburg on Saturday. That was what the event in Duisburg was meant to be about, the music. Of course, it proved to be about anything but. DJ Monica Kruser is a well-known figure at techno parties all over mainland Europe and a veteran of Love Parade. She was on stage in Duisburg shortly before the fatal crash happened, and she gave me her reaction.
When I finished my set, I talked to other colleagues who just arrived, and they told me, hey, there's something going on. People were really aggressive on the street when we passed by with the car and like jumping or next to the car. I was leaving the festival almost after my set, and then the driver, when we sat down, the driver turned around and said, I just got the information that 10 people were dead. So that was totally shocking for all of us, and we had to go through the street where all the ambulances were, and we saw already like dead people going, to this, well, where we were transporting, and it was shocking. It's still shocking, you know.
When you looked at the place where the event was staged and you looked at the level of security and the barriers and so on, did you sense any danger there?
Actually, yes, I did. I was even speaking to some of the people who were working there, and I said, hey, what's going on? And this is a ghetto. I see all the fences around this place. Why there are fences? And I could not understand it. And but I never thought this can be happening. Well, you don't want to think about it, you know.
What fences? How high were they? What did they look like?
Like really high, like 2.5 meters.
Is it a ticket event, Love Parade?
No, it was never like this. It was always not surrounded by fences, especially in Berlin. They changed the parade, the street. First, it was like in the inner city going through the main roads and houses. And then they said, no, it's too many people, over 1 million. So we have to change the parade to a park, or to the main street through a park, so if there's something is happening, people can escape, you know. And now I don't understand why they put the Love Parade on a very small city and on a place which fit only for 300,000 people, and in the past years we always had 1.5 million people, so it was like nobody thought, or I don't know, they want to make money or putting something for the better image for the city. I don't have a clue why they did it.
Now, you've done music sets at lots of love parades and you know the festival well.
Yeah.
Do you agree with the idea that it should just end now? It should be stopped forever?
Of course. Of course. I cannot imagine to play there once again. And, I mean, people died there and it is obvious that the promoters and the city made a huge mistake just to make it happen. But sometimes you just don't have to put everything through just to make a party and forget about the safety of people. So I cannot imagine to play there again, and I think it's respectless if you would do another love parade.
That's Monika Kruse, one of the DJs playing at Love Parade in Duisburg at the weekend. What do you think of the whole event? Should it still have the right to exist in the future? Send us your thoughts by email or join our Facebook conversation. Athene, or it could be Athena, got in touch via Facebook. She says the Love Parade is rubbish. If they really want to organise something as senseless as this, they should arrange it in big cities such as Berlin, where there are plenty of streets broad enough to be left at any time, even when there are millions of visitors. I'm glad that Love Parade isn't held anymore after this catastrophe, she says. Join the Facebook conversation. Just search for Europe Today on Facebook, or you can email us at worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. This is The World Service. You're listening to Europe Today. Now, it looks as though time is running out for Tony Hayward, chief executive of the energy giant GP. The company's board is assembling for a meeting at the firm's headquarters this evening, and the outcome will almost certainly be Mr. Hayward's departure. Our reporter Theo Leggett is outside the BP building in central London and joins me live. Theo, what's the scene?
Well, there's an element of comedy to all of this. There's at least 50 journalists here with cameras, satellite trucks, photographers, all waiting for an announcement that we're pretty sure is going to be made, but hasn't been made as yet. We're expecting to hear that Tony Hayward will fall on his sword, a victim of what many see as his rather inept handling of the problems in the Gulf of Mexico region, the disastrous oil spill there. Now, earlier today, we saw Carl-Henrik Svanberg, who's the chairman of BP. He went into the building. He's the man who will ultimately have to wield the knife. He's the man who dismisses the chief executive. He was followed about an hour later by Tony Hayward, the chief executive, the man under pressure, and about an hour after that, the heir apparent came in, Robert Dudley, BP's managing director, the man most people see as the likely successor, the man who will take over. Now, he's an American. He was born in New York, but he was raised in the Mississippi region, and there are many reasons why BP shareholders would welcome him taking charge of the company.
There's a long run-up to what's going on tonight. When will we know the outcome?
Well, this has to be done on BP's terms, and there is a good reason for that. Although it is highly likely that the decision to replace Tony Hayward has been made, and people within the company, off the record, have been willing to suggest that, it can't be confirmed until the board of directors has taken a formal decision and signed off on it. Now, we understand that's going to happen at a board meeting, which will be getting underway around now and may drag on into the evening. The BP board will want to talk to their colleagues at the Houston headquarters in the United States. And after that, and after the American markets have closed, we could get an announcement. But what we're hearing is nothing is likely to be confirmed until just before the UK markets open on Tuesday morning.
Is it daft to ask why Tony Hayward is in such trouble? Is all the difficulty in the Gulf of Mexico at the moment likely to be pinned on him?
Absolutely, and it's not a stupid question. I mean, everybody I've spoken to suggests that Tony Hayward did an excellent job right up until 19th of April. He was seen as a very competent manager. He's a geologist by training, oddly enough. He implemented cost cuts at BP. He helped get them back on track after their profits were slipping. But his handling of the spill in the Gulf of Mexico has been called into question, not least what many see as public gaffes. When he said on camera, for example, "I want this to be over. I just want to get my life back." Now, that went down very badly with the American public, because many people out there are losing their livelihoods. They'd like to get their lives back as well, and it's going to be a little bit more difficult for them. That's why he's been described in one American newspaper as the most hated and clueless man in America. And that's why the appointment of an American, and a man very familiar with the Gulf Coast region, is likely to be a good PR step, if nothing else.
It sounds as if Tony Hayward would probably be more or less unemployable in America now.
I think he's been unemployable in America since middle of April, yes. But the man replacing him, Robert Dudley, he'll go down well in America. There are, though, some question marks about how well he'll be accepted by other people that BP have to work with. This is the man, remember, who was in charge of BP's joint venture in Russia, TNK-BP, until a couple of years ago. Now, he had a big falling out with the Russian government. There were concerns over potential labour law violations, visa problems. Mr. Dudley claimed that a campaign of harassment against him and against other BP directors was led by the Russian government. He had to leave the country. BP still has its shareholding in that company, but whether they'll welcome Mr. Dudley in the hot seat, that remains to be seen.
Thank you very much, Theo Leggett in central London. Let's take a quick moment to listen again to the life and times of BP under the stewardship of Tony Hayward over recent months.
Tonight on World News, outrage. We learn from
I am angry and
video.
I am frustrated that BP...
We will keep our boot on the throat of BP.
BP's share price fell nearly 17% today to its lowest level.
We will make BP pay for the damage their company has caused.
With respect, sir, we drill hundreds of wells a year all around the world.
Yeah, I know, that's what's scaring me right now.
The worst case scenario just got worse.
The Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation into the spill.
Top Kill has failed after four futile days. BP is admitting defeat.
This wasn't our accident. This was a drilling rig operated by another company. It was their people, their systems, their processes. We are responsible not for the accident, but we are responsible for the oil and for dealing with it and cleaning the situation up.
I'm not stonewalling. I simply was not involved in the decision-making process.
I'm just amazed at this testimony.
There's no one who wants this thing over more than I do. You know, I'd like my life back.
Michael Hewson is a market analyst at CMC Analysts in London, and he's here with me in the studio. Michael, to what extent is what's going on here a case of a big company using the CEO as a scapegoat and therefore looking like it's got a clean slate?
I think there's an element of that, most definitely. I think the comments that Tony Hayward made in April, soon after the Deepwater Horizon disaster took place, were a little bit ill-advised. However, I mean, his track record up to that time, as your correspondent correctly said, had been very, very good. But it's definitely a case of they need to wipe the slate clean with respect to the American public. They need someone who's familiar to them. Bob Dudley fits that bill. There is a concern that he may not fit the bill with respect to the Russian part of the operations. So that could be a problem further down the line. But most definitely there is an element of, yeah, we need a clean slate. We need to draw a line under it. He's becoming the story as opposed to the Gulf of Mexico.
There's already been much written about the possibility of Tony Hayward, getting a big payoff. In other words, for doing financially very well out of messing up.
Well,
that's the claim.
Yeah, I mean, he's been there 28 years. So, I mean, what are you saying? I mean, is he not entitled to his, you know, compensation package? There are other companies involved in this
possibly disaster. Having presided over one of the biggest environmental disasters of recent times, the answer would be no.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, he is the CEO, the buck stops with him. But can you ultimately hold him completely responsible?
But the thing is, the buck doesn't stop with him, does it, if he gets paid vast amounts of money to leave? I mean, he's sort of being rewarded, that's what people will say.
Well, he's being made redundant, asked to leave. Unless you sack him under employment law, you have to basically comply the terms with his contract. And even if you behave badly and are made redundant, you're still entitled to your employment rights in law, irrespective of the circumstances surrounding the departure.
What do you think all this will mean to BP's share price, finally?
Well, we've already seen the share price. It's up 4.6% today at London close, around about £4.16. I think, you know, investors are sort of quite encouraged by it, but I don't think you'll be able to draw a line under the matter until such times as the well is capped. And right. I think that's really the underlying issue that BP needs to deal with right now.
Thank you very much, Michael Hewson. This is Europe Today. Now, French police have today been questioning the country's richest woman about suspected tax evasion and money laundering in a scandal that the government in Paris is eager to shake off. L'Oréal heiress Liliane Bettencourt, who's 87, was expected to be asked to explain two undeclared Swiss bank accounts. She could also have been asked about allegations by a former bookkeeper that she made illegal cash donations to Conservative Party politicians for President Sarkozy's election campaign. François Sergent is a reporter for the daily newspaper Libération, and he joins me now live from Paris. François, this is a story that's been running for weeks and weeks, much to the annoyance of the French government.
Oh, yes, and, but it was a good readership for Libération and for the French newspaper. Yeah, it's true, it's quite bad for Sarkozy, because as you say, there are some suspicion of financing by Bettencourt, but on the L'Oréal family, of party from the right of the Sarkozy's party, on one minister, Eric Woerth, seems to be in one of the beneficiary of the largest of Ms. Bettencourt. So it has been a kind of a soap for days and days. On every day, we got something new to show up. Yeah.
You heard me shamelessly speculating on what Liliane Bettencourt might have been saying to the French police today. Will we find out what she did say?
Up to now, we just had some hints from her lawyer. The lawyer was not with her, with the police, according to the French law. The lawyer said she tried. It was not a very bad moment for her. It seems that she was very vague, and she said she had memory lapses. As you said, she's 87, and her daughter is even saying that she's not that well, and she's too. And so it seemed up to now that she did not answer the question, as you said, about tax evasion, about the property of an island in the Seychelles she gave to a society photographer, which is at the origin of the scandal, and we know nothing about the money she's supposed to have given to Sarkozy's party.
Briefly, François, she was questioned at her house rather than being called to a police station. What sort of lifestyle does she live?
Well, you know, as we know now, she's living in a wonderful villa in one of the best suburbs in Paris. She seems to have about 20, 30 servants. Some of them have been taping our conversation, which is also the origin of the scandal.
I'm going to have to end it there. I apologise. François Sergent in Paris. Thank you. Now, it's the end of an era for one of Europe's top football clubs. In the last couple of days, two legendary players of Real Madrid have confirmed that they are leaving on Sunday after spending 24 years at the club, 15 of them as a first-team professional. José María Gutiérrez Hernández, commonly known as Guti, said his goodbyes. Then, earlier today, captain Raúl González ended his association after 16 years. I'm joined by our Spanish-based reporter Ashish Sharma. Ashish, why have these two decided to leave the club now after all this time? Have they become surplus to requirements?
Well, in an answer, yes. I mean, new coach Jose Mourinho has been honest in his assessment of the situation, and with both of them on the wrong side of 30, he made it very clear that they would have limited chances to play in the team. So both have a legendary status at the club. Raul in particular, he's a Madrid record goal scorer, won everything you can in club football, and has said that in his news conference, he grew up at Real Madrid, got married there, had all his children as a player there, and he feels that he still has unfinished business as a player.
Today has been the hardest and most difficult day for me in my whole career. I love football above everything else, and to have been a player for Real Madrid is beyond my wildest dreams. I still feel that I can play football, and I would like to continue playing for as long as my body will allow me to.
How will fans react to these two's departure?
Well, the Madrileños are very emotional as supporters, and they are very loyal to the players who do very well for them. Men will be hugely upset to see them go. They'll feel that they could have still contributed something in a small part, but I think generally they'll feel that they've done their service to the club, and they'll wish them all the best as they move on to a new career.
Thank you very much, Ashish Sharma in Spain. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're broadcasting live from Bush House in London. This is Europe Today.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to Listen.